You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2026 Giro d'Italia. The cycling podcast, every day on the ground at the Giro d'Italia since 2016. Today we are in Milano.
Well, actually, last kilometre, 20 seconds for the group. We're outside the Polti Visit Malta bus. Polti make vacuum cleaners, but they want the power, the suction power of the peloton to let them down at this point, don't they? What do you think? 18 seconds, they've got to get it at this point. What are they going to do? Maestri, Bais, who takes the win?
Can Mirko Maestri do it from Casone di Guastalla, province of Reggio Emilia?
Marianismo?
Oh, yeah.
Marcelluzzi?
We got Marcelluzzi in the front. We're supporting him, of course.
600 metres to go, 500 metres to go, 15 seconds. They got it, come on, they got it. They can't mess this up, Bellacci, surely.
Oh, look at the sprinters are coming, though. The train.
No, they're done. The frittis, you'd say. They're fried. The peloton's fried.
I think Bais is working for Maestri now. Marcelluzzi might be the fastest in the breakaway.
No, Dviesnes. No.
No.
Chi vince? Dviesnes.
No.
No, Bardani win. Still, the streak continues. 200 plus stages without
years.
A win for Bardani.
200 years.
Stop.
Tell us about the last 3 minutes of your life.
Yeah. We are very close. Mirko Maestri do second last year, second this year again. But the only way is try every day. I'm very proud of my team. They do grateful performance. They attack all days, and today normally they think sprint, but they have a lot of heart, and they put all they have, and they do second and fourth.
Ivan, what were you thinking at 200 meters ago? Were you thinking Bais? Were you thinking Maestri? What were you thinking?
Yeah, I really think Mirko won because he deserved. But it's okay, that's life, and we try again.
Ma quello che ha fatto la differenza fa rabbia, perché ho sentito dire che il gruppo ha sbagliato i tempi, ma non è che il gruppo ha andato tutti i corridori del gruppo, ma alla fine noi della fuga penso che
Michele Pelacci, buonasera.
Ciao Daniele.
We're in Milano. Milano da bere. That was
si.
The slogan from the 1980s, wasn't it? It was an advertising slogan. Who came up with that? It just means, it's a kind of strange slogan. It means Milan to sort of drink. But this slogan became synonymous with the boom time in Milan. You still hear it quite a lot. And we're drinking right now. But we're committing a heresy, Pelacci. Or I'm committing a heresy. Why is that?
I have no idea, actually. Oh, because of the Select and your
Spritz. Because of the Select, because I'm having a Spritz, and it's not Campari Spritz. The Spritz par excellence here is with Campari. This is the same color, but I'm drinking Select, which is the original Spritz from Venezia,
and that
Venice.
I'm eating a bit of a tramezzino, a sandwich. It's not from Milano, of course. It's from Roma. It's from Torino. Not famous in Milan, but I was hungry and needed a sandwich.
Pelacci, I didn't necessarily have very high expectations for today's stage, but we got a little taste of the action in the at the start of the episode. Bit of a musical montage there, us commentating, live commentating. Rob Hatch has nothing to worry about. Close to the finish line by the team buses. I thought Bardianismo was healing at one point because Marcelluzzi was looking good. Polti, of course, had two riders in the break. Maestri, you were very hopeful that Maestri might bring home the, what do we say yesterday, not bacon, but guanciale. Although bacon, being a UNOX, being a Danish-Norwegian team, bring home the bacon would be very appropriate, because that's what Frederik Wiesnes did. He won in Milan from a break of four riders on a day that we thought was destined to smile upon Little Trek. And Jonathan, Milan. Alas, that didn't happen. But Pelacci, all very exciting, wasn't it?
Amazing stuff. Loved all the stage, everything about it. You know, we went, Daniele will hear about this later, to the Giardini Indro Montanelli in Milano, close to the finish line. Indro Montanelli was a journalist covering the Giro d'Italia. He had one love, and that was the Fuji TV, the breakaway riders.
You were going to say Bardianismo then.
So, Montanelli was a supporter of anarchy, not only in cycling, but in society in general. During the 1947 Giro, Daniele, Montanelli called a lone fugitivo, a lonely breakaway rider, it was a stage from Perugia to Rome. He called our brother with faith in anarchy. We had faith in anarchy or on the Fuga today, and they made it to the finish line. Good stuff.
Excellent stuff, Pelacci. Excellent stuff. And there was other polemic as well. We thought there'd be polemic. Last time we had a similar stage. The last time I can remember there being a similar stage in the Giro d'Italia, it was 2009, centenary Giro d'Italia. And again, there was a sort of ciclismo out of context stage in the middle of the Giro that year in Milan, a city circuit. Of course, Pelacci, it was the famous, well, it was famously the comeback Grand Tour for whom?
2009, Lance Armstrong.
The controversial Lance Armstrong.
Let's go.
Yes, and well, he was in the thick of it that day because he was one of the most vocal riders who were complaining about things like tram tracks, and there was a bit of a neutralization in the end, and RCS, the Giro organization, were very upset with the way the riders behaved that day. They sort of unilaterally neutralized the stage, and the patron, the boss of the Giro d'Italia then, Angelo Zomagnan, said something along the lines of, as you get older, your legs get shorter and your tongue clearly gets longer. And he was referring to Armstrong. That was sort of a broadside aimed at Lance Armstrong. Today, we had a similar bit of polemica. We saw Jonas Vingegaard at the commissaire's car, and a neutralization of sorts also ensued today. But Pelacci, we're giving a lot away about the stage. This morning, in a highly irregular situation for us, we didn't go to the start in Voghera, did we? Because we were in the kitchen, as you would say, Pelacci. We're cooking. We're always cooking. We're cooking at kilometre zero for tomorrow. More on that later. So nothing from the start. We were going to talk about, well, we were going to maybe even play a conversation you had with Matteo Sobrero yesterday. It was a classic Pelacciata. And remind us what you were asking Sobrero about yesterday. It was about nicknames and also tiramisu.
Oh yeah, we had a pretty interesting and various topics were held in the conversation. So Jai Hindley posted an Instagram story with Sobrero on the picture saying that they are the parrucchini, the toupee. How do you say parrucchini? Toupee. Yeah, and I was wondering why. Sobrero was posting also photos of tiramisu and Garibaldi with the letters on that says Matteo Superiore. That was investigating all of this. He gave me great answers about how they were just making fun of each other's hair with Jai Hindley, and the tiramisu was a bit of a escape from regular food. It was a cheat meal, as they call it, and the little track boss and your nutritionist, whom we've been talking to. And lastly, Matteo Superiore is a reference to the family business of Sobrero, of course. They produce wine, Nebbiolo.
In the Lange.
Sì.
Very good dolcetto they make.
I think they live in Monforte d'Alba, which is
correct.
A fantastic place. And yeah, so Superiore because of the higher quality of their wine.
Well, Pelacci, we knew that they had their sights firmly set on a stage win today. I'm talking about Little Trek. Let's find out, shall we? Well, we know already that it wasn't the tiramisu, the pick-me-up, that they were looking for. But let's find out what did happen exactly in today's prosciuttometro.
Il prosciuttometro di Michele Pelacci.
Pelacci, how many prosciutti, please, today?
Listen, Daniele, I'm going to be very high on this, but I loved everything about this stage. Had all of it, had polemica, had Bardianismo, had Milano. So many people in Milano. Something was said about how you had a completely flat stage on a Sunday, which is unusual for the Giro d'Italia, but maybe it was also done to get in a big city. Can't do really do this on a weekday because of the traffic, because of the people working.
A lot of eyeballs on Giro d'Italia in Milan today, weren't there?
Yep. You could see 3-4 rows of people packing the streets. I have to give 4 prosciuttos to this stage, Daniele. Love all of this. Of course, the streak of Bardiani, the winless streak of this team did not end.
I mockingly and facetiously, Pelacci, suggested it was 200 years, the winless streak, in the start of the episode that we heard. But is it exactly 200 stages?
I think 210 now for Bardiani, and the last win for Polti, of course, was on Campo Imperatore on Gran Sasso in 2023. But let's dive right into the stage, which started this morning from Voghera, where Jonas Vingegaard was finally wearing the Maglia Rosa. Eulalio did not crack, he's still second in GC. And first in the youth classification, 2:26 down. Felix Gall is third to 15 seconds adrift. Jonathan Narváez was the new Chiclamino points jersey, and Yardi van der Lee wore the blue mountains jersey in place of Vingegaard. 159 riders left Voghera heading north towards Milan for this pancake flat stage. A four-man breakaway set off pretty early on. It's composed of Mirko Maestri and Mattia Baez of Poltivigit Malta, Martin Marcellusi of Bardiani, and Frederik Dversnes of UnoX. Marcellusi won the intermediate sprint in Pavia, Dversnes won the Red Bull kilometer, and four teams were leading the peloton, among others Lidl Trek, EF Education Interpost, Soudal Quickstep, and Unibet Rose Rockets.
Bit of MSN, just a little bit of them as well, I think.
Rhythm Vernon, you're correct, Daniele. Quite incredibly, as the kilometers were winding down and a polemica in the peloton was mounting, we'll discuss it later, probably the gap became smaller and smaller, but the breakaway was not caught. For a great surprise of everyone, the four riders in front were actually going to fight for the win. Under the Flamme Rouge, Maestri pulled for... Baez pulled for Maestri. Dversnes was the lone Norwegian against three Italians, and he prevailed, bringing home the very first win at the Giro d'Italia for Team UnoX.
And Pellacci, that sprint that we thought would be for first place, in the end it was for fifth place, and it was won by Paul Magnier ahead of Dylan Groenewegen. Tobias Lundt was seventh, Ethan Vernon eighth, Paul Penouet ninth, and Luca Mozzato 10th. Jonathan Milan way down in 14th place, and we heard an interview from him after the finish, and he sounded very forlorn, as you would expect. Not many opportunities left for Milan and the bigger men, the faster men, the sprinters. Pellacci, what does that mean in the general classification? Well, pretty much nothing worth talking about. I can't really see anyone of any significance who lost or gained any time or positions today. In the points competition, Paul Magnier has recovered the Chiclamino jersey from Jonathan Narváez. So it's a bittersweet day for Magnier. He now leads by 14 points. So it's 1-4-5 plays, 1-3-1 against Narváez. In the King of the Mountains competition, well, no points on offer today, so nothing changes there. Vingegaard still leads. Van der Lee will continue to wear the blue jersey, although he's miles away in second place. And in the youth classification, nothing has changed either. Afonso Eulalio leads by 1 minute and 56 seconds from Giulio Pellizzari. Pellacci, do you know who leads the team competition without looking? Guess. It's actually very close.
I have to say, maybe it's Red Bull.
Visma lead the team classification by 24 seconds from Red Bull.
Oh no, I got it wrong for 24 seconds.
24 seconds. And in third place is a surprising team name. The Motor Maestros Tudor Pro Cycling in third place. Largely, not to diminish the Motor Maestro and Larry's work, but largely due to Rondell and Stora Char, I would suggest. Anyway, Pellacci, let's hear from some of the interested parties after today's 15th stage. We're going to hear first from the UnoX, a jubilant UnoX Direct Sportif, Michael Blautzun, Danish Direct Sportif. And then we're going to hear from the aforementioned Motown Maestro, Larry, who is our man in the peloton. So he was the perfect man to tell us, A, what was happening with Vingegaard and the neutralisation, and also why he thought that group of four riders was able to stay away today. Fasten your seatbelts for some polemica.
Well, that was exciting and not expected, I guess.
No, it was not expected, but as I said this morning, Frederik, he said, I want to go in the break. And we said, okay, if you have the energy, it's okay for us. It's good, spectacular to do it also. It might be a sprint finish today, but if you don't try, you're not going to win. And when they got into the circuit after first lap, I was behind Frederik in the car, and we were talking about in the car, it could be possible because they were going pretty fast in the break. And with 60 errors almost, it was a nice circuit for a breakaway because a lot of people, not so much wind. But still, yeah, when we saw the last lap, we start believing.
Were you confident when you realised with 200 to go that they were going to make it? Were you confident that it was going to be your guy?
Yes. Frederik, after 2 weeks in the Grand Tour, he's still on a really good level, strong and powerful. So we were pretty convinced that if they got to the finish line, he would win. But first they had to get to the finish line, and luckily they did.
And this is your team's first year in Italia. I know you're in my first year in the World Tour, and I've been speaking to people in the team in the last few days, and they've said, well, we have a great team for the Tour, but this team is quite inexperienced. You've also had some illness. You've got a lot of big riders here, not necessarily climbers, but you've come away with a win.
It's unbelievable. We, as you said, inexperienced team. Four guys haven't done a Grand Tour before we started in Bulgaria, and we lost three guys already because of sickness and crashes. And but still, there's a great atmosphere in the team. The guys are unbelievable. They wake up every morning and believe that we have a chance today, and we back it, of course, 100% up. We have been really close with Legnesund for two days in a row, not in a row, but the last week. And so, of course, it's possible. But you have to be strong. And what we see every morning at the breakfast table is five top motivated riders. With a good culture and atmosphere, you can get very long in this business with good atmosphere and morale.
And rest day tomorrow, so you can really celebrate.
I think we're gonna have a glass of champagne or two tonight, and just happy that Tor Hushovd is here today. He had just arrived 2 hours ago. That he can be with us to celebrate and experience this great day.
Well done, thank you. Cheers. Well, Larry, we feared there'd be polemic, and there was a bit of polemic about the course again, I guess.
Oh, yeah, what did you see? The breakaway, maybe. Yeah.
What did you see and hear about there? So we saw Vingegaard the car. We imagined, we haven't been to Visma yet, we imagined he was upset that he thought it was dangerous.
Well, that actually doesn't surprise me, because I saw them like kind of go towards the back, and then I didn't see him for a while, and then I heard with one lap to go, they'd take the times, you know? But then the funny thing was like, I don't know, it didn't seem that clear. And then, like, I don't know, Derek G came up to me and he's like, Larry, what did you hear in the radio? I was like, well, they told me that, like, one lap to go, they take the GC time. He's like, okay, cool, cool. Then, like, halfway through the last lap, I saw him sit up and I saw no one else sit up. And then I was really nervous that I told him the wrong information. But apparently that was the case, but no one sat up.
It'd be very easy to get someone to lose time on GC just by spreading these rumors, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be. But I wouldn't do that.
Was it dangerous?
I mean, there were insane potholes. Let's just say it was the bumpiest circuit I've probably ever done. So when your underside is already not feeling great after 2 weeks of the Giro, it's not ideal. But yeah. I mean, I don't know. Someone hit a barrier. It was pretty sketchy. Yeah, it was pretty sketchy.
And Larry, you're our man in the bunch. Why did the brake stay away today? Are you going to use the M word?
I'm usually someone who would say, I totally believe that they stayed away, like, legit and on legs. And for sure, they're strong guys. But, I mean, literally every single teammate of every sprinter was pulling as hard as they could to bring that brake back. And the whole day we were going super fast. So, I mean, I don't want to be that guy, but I'm going to be that guy.
Just for the avoidance of doubt, Larry is insinuating that
I'm not insinuating anything. I just said what I said, you know.
but they were getting help from the motorbikes. Not that they were sitting on motorbikes, Larry. But they could have been.
They could have been, because they were going really fast.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Saily, which is an app that can help save you money when you're using your mobile phone abroad. Back in the day, we used to have to swap out the SIM card in the phone, buy a new one at the airport, and sign up to the local network to stay connected when using the mobile phone abroad, or face significant roaming charges. Well, Saily cuts through all of that and makes it very simple to carry on using your phone whenever you're on holiday or away for work, as if you were at home. As you're a listener to the Cycling Podcast, you'll get an exclusive 15% discount on your first Saylee data plan as long as you use the code CYCLING at checkout. You can download the Saylee app from your app store or go to saylee.com/cycling, and those details are in the show notes. If you travel around a lot, you'll probably want the Saylee Ultra plan, which covers you for everywhere and every eventuality. But if you're just going on holiday to one country or maybe a couple of countries, you can choose the plan that suits you. And you only need to download the app once, the eSIM. Once it's on your phone, you select the plan that covers the countries that you're visiting, and away you go. It will save you mobile data because it's got a built-in ad blocker, and because it comes from the people behind NordVPN, you know that it will protect your privacy too. So go to saylee.com/cycling. That's saylee.com/cycling, or download the Saylee app in your app store. Before I hand back to Daniel, just a quick reminder that the next episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina will be coming on the Giro d'Italia's rest day. Rose and the team will be looking back at all of the recent racing and looking ahead to the Giro d'Italia women, which starts on the final weekend of the Giro d'Italia. So we've got daily episodes from the Giro d'Italia women coming up very soon.
Pelacci, poor old Frederik Dviesnes. I say that. Today was the best day of his life, probably. The best day of his career, certainly. The biggest win of his career. He previously won a stage in Tirreno. He'd won a stage in the Arctic Race of Norway. He'd won the GC and the Tour of Rhodes. 29 years of age. A solid pro, but not a world beater. He was thrilled, as you would expect, after the finish. But Pelacci, I felt as though I was sort of bursting his balloon a little bit, because in the press conference, I asked him about the influence of the motorbikes today, and he admitted, he sort of admitted that they probably did have an influence today, but he also kind of expressed an opinion which I, as an armchair viewer, sort of share, that everyone knows these advantages are sometimes available from the motorbike, and sometimes, he also said, that advantage is in the hands of the peloton. Sometimes the motorbikes are favouring the peloton more than they are the breakaway. Today, it just so happened that, well, as Larry said, and I also spoke to a few people off the record, direct sportifs who didn't want to sort of expose themselves, but they also thought that the motorbikes were heavily, heavily in favour of the breakaway today. And Pelacci, just looking at the average speed, pretty extraordinary. 51.391 kilometres an hour was the winning average speed today. And another thing that Dviesnes said, which I think is important to point out, and I think it's a valid point, that when you're going at those speeds at 51 kilometres an hour, to ratchet it up to 52 and 53 and 54, and what you need to do to get back 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 40 seconds in the last few kilometres is very, very difficult. You're pushing the limits of what people can do.
You're correct. And with 51.063 kilometers per hour, this was the second fastest road stage in Giro's history, behind the 51.2 that was recorded in the Matera to Brindisi stage in 2021. It was won by Arnaud Demar. Daniele, this final circuit of 16K in the city had to be done four times, and it was tricky, had many turns. It was twisty, and as you said, the speed was not easy to be kept up. The peloton had a hard time, but I think something can also be said about how the teams were too confident. Some of the teams were too bullish in their sort of, fiducia.
The confidence.
That they were
going to make it. Yeah, they were overconfident.
See.
Yeah, we see this quite a lot now, and often, you know, we saw it in Sofia, didn't we? And that day. I think they probably did make the same misjudgment that they made today, if you can call it misjudgment. I mean, most of the riders in the peloton that I heard who gave interviews said that it wasn't really a misjudgment at all. It was simply that the guys at the front, for whatever reason, went incredibly, incredibly fast. But often they do leave it very, very late. And as I said, I think in Sofia, these old dogmas, these old rules of thumb that used to exist about 1 minute for every 10 kilometers, they have gone completely out of the window because of aerodynamics and maybe because of motorbikes as well. I don't know whether, you know, I sometimes sort of laugh when people talk about the influence of motorbikes, and there doesn't seem to be any perspective about how bad it's always been. You know, particularly after Milan-San Remo, for example, there was talk there about Pogacar and him benefiting from the motorbikes. But Milan-San Remo was the most flagrant, has always been the most flagrant example of motorbikes helping whoever attacked, whoever got the jump. You used to see a huge phalanx of motorbikes ahead of the whoever did attack. And as I said earlier, you know, this is well known among riders that that advantage is there to be had, and they would have been well aware of that today. It's very difficult. I find it very difficult, Palacci. I don't know about you. Maybe we don't pay enough attention to the race because, for example, today we're in the press room and we're sort of working, we're kind of watching, looking at the screen. But sometimes when I've interviewed riders, they've said to me, "Well, did you not see it yourself?" And maybe it's that I don't possess the specialist knowledge, and maybe because I haven't been a pro bike rider myself, sometimes I find it quite hard to know how big the advantage it is that riders are getting from the motorbike.
And a lot has been said in past years, for many years actually, on the distance, right? Is 5 meters enough? Is 10 meters enough? 20, 25, 30, 50? It's tough for us to understand. I think sometimes motorbikes do not do it on purpose. They just dare to do their own job. I don't know. I was talking to Mirko Maestri at the finish line, right? He said the circuit was demanding. They knew it. Maestri said he woke up like with this mentality of attacking. Didn't matter how was the stage. He was going to attack today, going to the finish line, trying to make it. He said he was angry because he heard some questions were made to him like, yeah, the peloton was leaping, right? I don't know. Hanno dormito. And Maestri said, no, they didn't sleep. It was us. Mm. It was us who were pretty strong.
Yeah. Tvizna says, yeah, if you want to talk about motorbikes, there were four motorbikes in the group. We were the four motorbikes.
Interesting. But I think we should give credit to the breakaway, of course. And I don't know, something has to be said about they got to the finish line. And then under the Flamme Rouge, it was a pretty fair sprint between the three of them, right? Marcellusi, Versnes, and Maestri. Again, a Norwegian prevailed. Daniele, in Italy, it looks like soccer. They eliminated us from the World Cup. Now they're winning it at the Giro d'Italia. This Norwegian, man.
Palacci, I guess it was so frantic, that chase. The fact that Polti had two guys there, it really didn't make any difference. There was no chance there to cook up, as you would say, any sort of smart winning team tactic there. It was literally make sure we stay away and then do what you can in the last 200 meters, and that's kind of what happened, wasn't it?
You're correct, and it was a heartbreak at the team bus. I was staying at the Bardiani team bus, the Polti Visit Malta team bus, where Cristiano De Rosa, bike brand of course, De Rosa of Bardiani, there was Francesca Polti, the boss of the Polti business. They were sort of smiling. They were saying, UCI points, let's go, UCI points. But on the other hand, they knew they were this close to a win, a much needed and much anticipated win for them. Did not come.
Palacci, I was alerted by a listener on Strava, and we were having fantastic feedback on Strava particularly, but on all social media. Lots of good questions that are coming in. But one of our Norwegian listeners suggested to me that I should ask Fredrik Dviesnes, in fact, I'll just pull up it was Erling Evensen, suggested to me I should ask Fredrik Dviesnes about his 1,000 kilometer ride in 2020. Unfortunately, this was after I got this message after the press conference, and I'd already shamed Dviesnes about his use of motorbike, the motorbike slipstream. But this is a curious little story from the COVID period. Fredrik Dviesnes essentially set out, I think, with a friend to break the Norwegian record for the most kilometers cycled in a single sitting. And I think the number he eventually managed was 1,000 kilometers.
Single sitting, I mean, he never got off the bike, not even once, not even for...
Hang on, Pilacci, I need to check this. I'm not sure, but it was a long ride. It was a very long ride, Pilacci. And he also raised money for charity, Norwegian People's Aid. Yeah, so that's maybe something we should ask him about in the next few days, Frederik de Vries. Maybe that's my way of sort of worming back into his good books after sort of suggesting that he benefited from illegal motorbike assistance today.
Well, I think you used an interesting verb, worming, because he's a guy who's been, you could see on his Instagram, he's been doing the heat protocol, as they call it right now, with Kiwi and Piumini on his body while he's doing the rollers. This guy has been training in the heat forever, and today maybe played a factor because it was super hot day in Milano.
Well, I think this team are ahead of the game on that. They've got Olaf Alexander Bu, who's the head of performance there, and he's picked up a lot of know-how from the world of triathlon. And both, well, we know that they go very well in cold weather. We've seen it many times in the spring classics and so on and so forth. But they have invested a lot of time and a lot of effort and probably a lot of money as well into heat training. So, yes, you're right, Pilacci. It doesn't surprise me. Incidentally, Pilacci, what's the furthest you've ever ridden in one sitting?
It's a great question. So, in one day?
Yeah, one ride. What's your longest ever ride?
250 with 5K of elevation. Solid stuff for me, I must admit. Yeah,
I almost did 180k. Madonna Campiglia. We were talking about that today the Cazzeggio. We're doing our slightly shambolic videos on Strava, and we talked about Marco Pantani and Madonna Campiglia today. And my 180 kilometers was Trento, Madonna Campiglia, Trento, a sort of convoluted loop.
Fantastic.
Those environs.
You want to hear, going back to the stage, about a couple of quotes I found fantastic from the protagonist of today. Because, again, Mirko Maestri, one of my favorite writers of this Giro d'Italia, nicknamed Paperino. What's the name of Paperino in
Duck.
English?
Yeah, but Donald Duck? No, Daffy Duck?
Yeah, Daffy Duck, probably.
Yeah.
So he's from Reggio Emilia, the province next to mine, from a place called Casoni di Luzzara, in La Bassa, in the flattest part of the
Donald Duck,
of the province.
Sorry.
And Daniele... Second time, he finishes second in the stage of the Giro d'Italia. He's become sort of a breakaway legend at the Giro. We remember his amazing breakaway with Julian Alaphilippe in the stage to Fano in 2024.
They became friends. They became sort of pen pals afterwards, didn't they? They kind of exchanged messages every New Year or whatever, exchanged jerseys, I think.
And it was super interesting because Maestri said Alaphilippe was his idol, but they're the same age. Interesting. Right after the finish line, Maestri went to Baez and wanted to apologize his teammate, right? Because he gave everything for him. Maestri said, Baez died for me and gave his soul. Also, I was looking at Instagram after the finish line. I didn't get really this quote. Maestri said, sooner or later, I'll become a bee. Diventerò un'ape. I'll become a bee. What does it mean?
Yeah, maybe he's signing for Visma.
Oh, wow.
Huh.
And news there.
Exclusive. Huh. Well, it's... he would be treading the same path as Pigansoli, wouldn't he? So maybe that's in the offing. I mean, a guy like him, Pilacci, it's no mean feat for pro Conti division rider to be very competitive in the Giro d'Italia. I mean, this is something we're sort of noticing in this Giro, that the gulf between the best riders in the peloton and the least gifted riders in the peloton is becoming quite wide. That's what we feel. We've heard a lot of people refer to this and talk about this. And it's very hard. I mean, I spoke to Giovanni Elena, the Polti Visit Moto Direct Sportif, after the day to Fermo, when they had four guys in the break. And they were in what looked like a great situation. But he said, look, these guys are just not as good. They're nowhere near as good as the World Tour Pros. It's very limited what we can do in that situation. So for Mirko Maestri to be as competitive is as he is, maybe suggest to me that he belongs in the World Tour and not in a Pro Conti Division team.
What a working class hero, Daniele. He's been always in the front of the peloton, always pulling for his teammates. Big ruler, Maestri is.
You're definitely not a working class hero with your prosciutto di Parma empire and flats and various, you know, your property portfolio in Parma.
Yeah, I was talking about Maestri, of course. The guy will be fighting again for his first stage win at the Giro. And, you know, I remember one of the happiest moments he always says this about Mirko Maestri life, was when he got called up once for the Italian national team. He finally got to wear the national jersey, I think it was for the European Championships 3 years ago. He was the happiest man alive just because he got the one chance, right?
Pelacci, we talked earlier about the bit of a polemica, a faint whiff of polemica to do with the circuit and the parallels with 2009. In the end, it didn't last very long, did it? We saw Jonas Vingegaard go back to the chief commissaire's car, and there was a fairly animated conversation, and then the decision was made that the last lap effectively was going to be neutralised for GC time. It was 16 kilometres, wasn't it? In his press conference, Vingegaard said that he'd spoken to a few riders. They were all in agreement, and he thought that it was his responsibility in the pink jersey to go back and be a spokesperson for the peloton. He didn't want to name the other riders, but he sort of talked about senior riders. I mean, I think this is fine. This is fair enough. Obviously, the question then comes, and it did come to Vingegaard in the press conference, well, why wasn't this thought about? Why wasn't it organised in advance? The reality is that, well, in his case, this is interesting as well from a sort of sporting point of view, thinking about the stages to come. He hasn't reconned any stages in the Giro d'Italia, as far as I know. That's what the team's been telling me. So he definitely wouldn't have known what it was going to be like. He certainly didn't recon the, you know, the city circuit in Milan. But you might ask why the CPA, why the Riders' Union hadn't already sort of made a decision on behalf of all of the riders to engage in a negotiation with the organisers such that what was the outcome today, i.e. the last lap being neutralised, that wasn't agreed in advance. These things, I mean, they never really reflect well on professional cycling, and they show us sort of clearly how everything is done on the fly in professional cycling. It's quite funny, incidentally, that Larry told us, Derek, you know, about the sort of word of mouth aspect of it, that some of the riders in the peloton don't even know what's going on. They don't even know if it's been neutralised or not. And you could one day get a situation, as Larry outlined today, you could one day get a situation where a key GC rider thinks a race has been neutralised, and in actual fact, it has not.
Wow, I was listening to Rai, the Italian TV, and they were saying how the finish line for the GC was previously put at 5k to go, then moved back once more at 16k to go. So literally two times changing on the fly. And some talks were happening in the team cars. Stefano Rizzato, their motorbike commentator from Rai, said that the Decathlon team car and the Visma team car were talking a lot to each other. So I don't know, it's a bit of, you know, it makes the race look a bit of, I feel like, a bit di paese.
A bit like a village kermesse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Isn't
it? Yeah. No, it does. It does, Pelacci. But we thought there might be something today, didn't we? Because we know how difficult it is to bring the Giro d'Italia into a city like Milan. Okay, Sunday was probably a good day, probably the only day to do it. Caused maybe minimum disruption. I didn't get the sense today that it had caused huge disruption, so sort of thumbs up to RCS for that. But there was always going to be something because, you know, the roads here are complicated. Pelacci, we said a couple of days ago, you've lived here, I used to live here. The tram tracks in Milan are a big problem if you ride a bike. I had a crash once, you know, getting my front wheel stuck in tram tracks, and there are San Pietrini, there are these big cobblestones as well. So there's a lot to deal with, a lot of complications. But anyway, the Giro d'Italia has got through this stage kind of unscathed, so sigh of relief for everyone. Pelacci, should we have today's chiacchierata del giorno?
Let's do it.
The Giro d'Italia, of course, traditionally has ended in Milan. The majority of the time, for the majority of the race's history, it has ended in Milan, and that was certainly the case in 2012. Pelacci, who won the Giro d'Italia in 2012?
Was it Ryder Hesjedal, right?
It was
the Canadian
Ryder Hesjedal. Huh. one of the most surprising winners of the Giro d'Italia. Interesting addition. We were talking about it in the car today. The fantastic, one of the classic stages to the Stelvio, won by Thomas de Gendt. And the final time trial where de Gendt still sort of had a chance. So did Purito Rodriguez. But it was Ryder Hegedal who triumphed. Since then, and particularly since he retired 10 years ago, Ryder Hegedal has become a bit of an elusive figure, sort of Yeti, Loch Ness Monster style figure in professional cycling, in the sense that, you know, he has been living in Hawaii for a long time. Don't see him at races, doesn't really give interviews. But I knew that he was at the race today, so I made it my business to find Ryder Hegedal. What you're about to hear is a typically sort of enigmatic Ryder Hegedal conversation. He didn't give away too much. He sort of told me as well off mic that actually in his business life, in his professional life, things are going pretty well. He started up he's heavily involved in forestry, Palachi.
Wow.
And things are going well on that front, but he didn't want to talk about it because he didn't want to jinx it. Things are going so well at the moment. Anyway, what you're about to hear is my chiacchierata del giorno with the 2012 Giro d'Italia champion Ryder Hegedal.
La chiacchierata del giorno. The chin wag of the day.
Okay, the Giro d'Italia 2012 winner, the sort of Loch Ness monster of former Giro d'Italia winners. We don't see it at races much nowadays, but Ryder Hegedal, it's great to see you.
Thank you.
It's great to see you. What brings you here today?
I got the invite from Castelli Clothing. Great, great partner and friend there. Won the Giro in Castelli Clothing, so we have that bond forever. And it's a big, big year this year, 150-year anniversary for Castelli. So what better place to be in Milan at the Giro d'Italia together?
Good memories for you?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely riding around just today on the pavers or cobbles, whatever you want to call it, around the city here. Flashbacks to the time trial. That was a little sketchy, but I pulled it off. So, yeah, it's pretty fun.
When you think back to that Giro d'Italia, what are the images that come most readily to mind for you?
The moments where it was for me. I remember all the key moments where I still was in it, I still had a chance, and you know, they all come together, obviously, for winning the race. So it's a great memory to have because every moment led to that. So they're all really good, actually.
I talked about the sort of legend of Ryder Hegedal. Well, it's a sort of puzzle that we've put together from your Instagram and other things. It seems to be you remind me a bit of Fleetwood Mac when they retired to Hawaii. The two guys from Fleetwood Mac, they retired to Hawaii, just surfing, chilling out. I mean, what is life like for you now? What's it been like the last 10 years?
It's good. I mean, it's actually 10 years since I retired, 2016. So it's a bit of a milestone, I guess, maybe. So, yeah, 10 years on from racing, you know. It's good. I mean, it's hard in the beginning, I think. Anyone can attest to that. The difference from, you know, all you know for, you know, for me, 20 years racing bikes and then basically having your own choices and free time and find your way and do what you like and see how that works and still maybe making mistakes and moving forward. So, yeah, I mean, I'm healthy. I'm happy. 45 years old. It's good.
Same as me. You're in good shape.
Yeah, I try.
Different shape to me. I think you do. You've got into a different kind of physical activity. I'm more into running. And you've put on a bit of muscle, haven't you?
Yeah, I got a bit into the gym there the last couple of years, just to kind of see what normal for 6'3" is, you know. So I'm leveled out about 200 pounds, 90 kilos. Feels a little more healthy. I got up to about 227, and that didn't work with the bike. That didn't feel good, so knocked it back down a little bit.
I mean, you'd win the bench press. I might win the 10K run. But right, it just last couple of things. So what's a typical day look like? And where does surfing come in? This is the image I have of you, that you're a big surfer.
Well, I'm going to disappoint you. There's zero surfing. I lived in Maui, too, so imagine that. So now Costa Rica. Gym, golf. I'm a big golfer. Love.
What are you playing now?
Pardon?
What are you playing off these days? What's your handicap?
Handicap? Probably about a 12. Mid-80s is good golf. That's kind of where I'm stuck.
So that could be the decider between you and me, because that's roughly why I'm off these days.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I got the time and effort to get into that low to high 70s is a bit tough. But no, golf, beach, biking, gym, good food, sunshine. That's it.
And a Giro d'Italia legend. Well, Ryder, listen, it's great to see you after quite a long time. And it's good to see you being honoured properly by the Giro d'Italia as well.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I think they remember me, but it's good to be here. Thanks a lot.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Pelacci, in a change to regular programming, we're not going to have our usual vignette, our usual montage from our travels today. That's coming. Rest assured, that is coming. But I thought, since we were talking about a sort of rare animal in terms of Giro d'Italia history, and someone who perhaps unfairly, Pelacci, I'm going to say unfairly, might be referred to as a bit of a one-hit wonder. Certainly, it was the only Grand Tour rider Hegde won, the 2012 Giro d'Italia, and he didn't win a huge number of races besides the Giro d'Italia. So people might call him that one-hit wonder, but he might be the reluctant owner of such a nickname. But Pelacci, I thought this would be the perfect opportunity to tease tomorrow's Kilometre Zero, which is about a rider who sort of proudly wears that title, that moniker, One Hit Wonder. He's the One Hit Wonder par excellence of the Giro d'Italia in the last, well, it's from 10 years ago. I'm talking about 2016. Pelacci, who do you think I'm talking about?
I think you're talking about, I was there to witness this amazing moment, the Russian
Alexander Foliferov.
La migliore tempo battendo nello sprint addirittura anche Stefan Kung, e infatti Foliforov realizza il miglior tempo 28:39 con una media oraria di 22:617.
Even when I retired, I refused all interviews because I don't like media, let's say, in general. But now I think I'm ready after 10 years to tell some words about me, because it's really a big interest.
Centesimi, la vittoria è per Alexander Foliforov. Stesso tempo per la maglia rosa, così come era successo nella prima giornata.
What did you do? They asked me, what did you do? How is it possible? I told, I don't know. I just won. I don't know how. I just rolled the pedals and that's it. And I was the fastest. It's unbelievable. Still, for me, it's still very, it's difficult to understand it. It is like it is.
Pelacci, one hit wonder. Alexander Foliferov is a one-hit wonder. He's proud to call himself a one-hit wonder. He's been in the cycling news in the last couple of weeks because there have been people who competed in that 2016 Giro d'Italia who have been saying it was a disgrace that he won that time trial. He must have cheated. He must have done something untoward. Well, in tomorrow's Kilometre Zero, I get the full truth, or Alexander Foliferov's truth, at least, about that 2016 Alpe di Susi time trial. So that's coming tomorrow. Now it is time, Palacci, to hear a little bit more about what we got up to today in Milano. Palacci, where are we?
Daniele, we are in Giardini Indro Montanelli in northeastern Milano. It's a park. It's, yeah, very green again. It's big and it's close, very close to Porta Venezia and the area, the finish line of today's stage at the Giro d'Italia.
It is, Palacci, and that name, Montanelli, I don't know if we've mentioned it already in the Giro d'Italia this year, but Palacci, we're standing by an Indro Montanelli statue. Do you know why these gardens are called the Giardini Montanelli?
So why? Probably, I don't.
Okay, so Indro Montanelli, you're going to tell us who he was in a minute, but he was almost assassinated. He was shot here by the Red Brigade in 1977, if I'm not mistaken. In fact, Palacci, do you know what it was? It was the 2nd of June 1977 during the Giro d'Italia. Francesco Moser was in the pink jersey. He didn't win that Giro. It was Michel Pollentier went on to win the Giro.
Wow. He later went on, I think, to found one of Silvio Berlusconi's newspapers, Il Giornale. And I think on the front page of Il Giornale, there is still founded by Indro Montanelli. The man was one of the nation's most important and most criticized and talked about and debatable and controversial figures for the entire 20th century, basically. He was born in Fucecchio in 1909.
Same as Andrea Taffi.
Interesting.
If I'm not mistaken.
Monument winner, right?
Yeah.
Andrea Taffi. And
multiple.
Interesting. I have to dig deep in the cycling, but Daniele, Montanelli used to write about the Giro d'Italia. This is why we are interested in his figure, which is again controversial one, because for example in the early 30s he embarked as a volunteer on a journey to Ethiopia to fight for the colonies in Italy for the fascist empire of Benito Mussolini, and he had sympathies back then for the fascism and that whole ideology. And what happened next is he came back, fascism of course was dead. And he had to endure sort of a purge at the Corriere della Sera. He was sent, in fact, to the Giro d'Italia.
This was this era, wasn't it, Palacci, when some of the great writers in Italy, Dino Buzzati, you've written a thesis on this, your university thesis on this, but some of the greatest writers in Italy got sent to the Giro d'Italia to do the sort of colour pieces, and Montanelli was one of them in 1947, 1948.
It was a way for them, for him too, to talk about a country that was just came out of the Second World War. It was in big trouble and it was sort of rebuilding itself. And they found it a way to travel around Italy, and Montanelli himself wrote some interesting articles about Italy.
He was one thing that I think everyone recognized early on was that he was completely under the spell of the Giro d'Italia. A lot of these writers were. They came here and they went away feeling as though their kind of worldview and their view of their own country had changed. One thing that's maybe pertinent today that Montanelli once wrote, Palacci, the Giro d'Italia has the strange ability to transform every day of the week into a Sunday, into a special day, effectively, he was saying.
In front of the statue now, we were talking before about how now feminists and groups of people are putting throwing some vernice,
paint defacing. This statue has been defaced numerous times, and there have been campaigns to have this park renamed because it emerged in the 60s in a chat show in the 1960s. He admitted that, you talked about his time in Ethiopia, Abyssinia, as it was called them in Italy. He claimed that he'd married a 12-year-old girl when he was there, and he was obviously a lot older. So this and other things, Palacci, you refer to other controversies as well. Those Giro d'Italia, just to go back to that for a second, the ones that he followed, I mean, there were two great additions to follow, because 1947 was maybe the greatest duel between Coppi and Bartali, won by Coppi in the end.
Then the following year, 1948, was polemica because Fiorenzo Magni was the eventual winner, but Fausto Coppi, he left the race in protest because Magni had been receiving too many pushes from the fans.
Interesting. It was a very different era, of course. I remember in his writings, Montanelli was very happy about Fiorenzo Magni. Magni was considered a fascist-leaning writer as well. So he had the favor of Montanelli for sure.
Pellacci, I'm going to read one last quote from Montanelli's writings on the Giro d'Italia, which again I thought was particularly pertinent today. Montanelli wrote, Charles V, you Spanish to speak with God, French to speak with ministers, Italian to speak with women, German to speak with soldiers, and Czechoslovakian to speak with the devil. If he had lived longer, he would have had to learn a sixth language to speak with bicycle racers. Milanese. The Giro d'Italia speaks Milanese, even if in the end it's some Tuscan or rider from Romagna who wins. Pellacci. That was us on the Indro Montanelli Trail earlier today in Milano, a city of great cycling heritage, in a region of great cycling heritage. You were keen to talk about this today. Is there anything else that you wanted to share just about Lombardy and professional cycling? This was sort of a pet theory you had, that Lombardy has kind of fallen from grace, but then we thought about it a bit more, and there are quite a lot of decent riders from Lombardy at the moment, but more in the north of the region, for example, the Valtellina.
Exactly. Daniele, you're correct. So Lombardy has been always the culla del ciclismo.
Yeah, the sort of heartlands, the cradle of cycling in Italy.
But especially in the poorest part, flat part of the pianura, L'Arco Guerra was from Mantova, notoriously, because he won the first Maglia Rosa.
Pellacci, the squirrel of the Navigli, lo scoiattolo dei Navigli, who's that?
Luigi Galletti, who won the Giro a couple of times in the 30s. These riders, including the very first winner of the Giro d'Italia, Luigi Ganna, 1909, used to come to Milano by bike. That's how they trained. They were muratori, construction workers.
Yeah, brickies, bricklayers.
And now, you don't have these many Lombardi riding the Giro anymore. Among 41 riders from Italy riding the Giro, 9 are from this region, a region that has a lot of traffic, a lot of people. While riding the bike, they are hit by cars. For example, Daniel, I was reading that in 2023, 39 people were shot, were killed by cars, were killed by incidents riding the bike, and more than 4,000 were wounded. That's unacceptable, of course.
Yeah, it's a very busy region, of course, a lot of traffic, heavily populated as well. But nonetheless, a region with a lot of ciclismo heritage, a lot of bike manufacturers, component manufacturers. You mentioned De Rosa earlier. That's a classic Lombard cycling brand, Bianchi Colnago.
Legnano back in the days.
Yeah, the list goes on. Pellacci, a couple of questions. Keep your questions coming in. Jack Davis asks, not sure if there has been a Daniel and Pellacci origin story shared on the pod before. People demand it. I'm not sure they really demand it, Jack. But you can have it. And Pellacci, you and I first met. I became acquainted with you because you were working for another podcast. You were working with my friends, Kautz and Leonardo Piccione, for the Bidon podcast, an Italian language podcast. And we would find ourselves very often side by side in the mix zone. And I suppose you could say we hit it off.
Yeah.
We hit it off.
It's correct.
Yeah, this sort of fraternal, paternal bond.
I remember the first question you asked me was a stage to Lavarone, wasn't it?
Yes.
They had to climb the Menador, and Santiago Buitrago won that day. And I was one of the very few people who previously in the Giro d'Italia interviewed Buitrago. And you were...
I wanted to know about the level of his Italian.
Exactly. And you were asking me some questions, and I probably answered you like, I don't remember anything. But yeah, that was the first time.
Well, we've come a long way since then, haven't we, Pellacci? That was a few years ago now. And yeah, unfortunately, the Bidon chaps, they haven't been able to do a daily podcast in the last couple of years. So I leapt at the opportunity to have Pellacci on board and made him a huge offer, which he couldn't refuse. Pellacci's been
you've been a lot calmer today, haven't you? You've had a lot less energy, which from my point of view has been a good thing, because I know I didn't manage to break you on the run this morning. You were probably closer to breaking me, but you fortunately, I think, had some of the numbers knocked out of you today. So we've been on much more of a sort of we've found our equilibrium in energy levels. Anyway, Palacci, should we talk now? Well, we're off to Switzerland in 5 minutes when we finish this podcast, but we should talk briefly about last night's dinner.
You said we had another question, right? Had two questions, didn't we? All right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think we'll leave it at that for now, because we're getting so many questions, and they are all fantastic. Maybe we should do a whole episode, but actually, where we get through all of them. Because one a day really isn't enough. Anyway, we will now talk about last night's dinner, and not tomorrow's stage, but the next day's stage.
La tappa di domani, la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Palacci, last night's dinner?
Oh, it was a great, fantastic dinner as well, with risotto
again.
Yeah, I had a battuta di carne or tartare once again as an antipasto. The wine was fantastic still.
Yeah, the Barbera. We've been going for the Barbera rather than Nebbiolo the last couple of days. It was Barbera has very high alcohol content, tends to. Palacci, yesterday was a 15.5. But shared between three people, I think it's reasonable.
Yeah, it was. And Daniele, risotto with guanciale, had pecorino on it as well. Really lovely. In Piedmont, it's pretty good food, generally.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's reputed to be the best. Well, with your region, Emilia-Romagna, Piedmont is sort of reputed to be the best gastronomic region in Italy. Palacci, we are leaving Italy altogether tonight. We are leaving all tonight. And the Giro d'Italia is leaving altogether the other side of the rest day on Tuesday. Just tell us briefly about it.
We're going to the Swiss Italia, right? The Canton Ticino from Bellinzona to Cari. It's a pretty short stage once again, 113 kilometers. There's a bit of a circuit, Daniele, in the climbs of Torre and Leontica before we head down to Lavorgo. There's a Red Bull kilometer at the bottom of the climb to Cari, 11.6 kilometers. First category climb, 8% average gradient. It will be almost an unipuerto, if we can say.
Hockey stick.
Yes, and we will have a GC battle on mountain that are in Switzerland for the Giro d'Italia.
By then, Palacci, I'll have introduced you to Rivella, my favourite soft drink, which we'll be stocking up on in Switzerland. General feelings about Switzerland? I'm a big fan of Switzerland. Il Barone hates it.
I've never been to Canton Ticino, actually, or very few times, so I'm curious.
Well, Palacci, that's all to come on Tuesday. We'll be back then. In the meantime, look out for One Hit Wonder, the story of Alexander Foliferov's extraordinary stage win in 2016 Giro d'Italia. Palacci, buonasera.
Ciao, Daniele.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.